Hey, it's Amelia, aka Big Tit.
And I'm Natasha, aka Little Tit.
And together, we're the Graveyard Girls.
Hello.
And welcome to a brand new episode.
Yeah, we're doing one together.
Yeah, kind of. Joint episode. I always think it's weird, like, because like, we call them joint episodes. It's like the other ones, I call them normal episodes.
Yeah.
And then I was a bit conscious of the fact I mentioned it was a normal episode in the other episode.
By normal, we mean like true crime and mysteries.
Yeah, it's our normal timetable.
It's our normal one, it's not our Patreon. And by joint, we mean we present a case to each other.
Yeah, which I really like doing. Revolving. I do like doing these joint ones.
I do too, but it's too much work to do it every week.
It is. It's like, I liked returning. I feel like it's more like what we did originally,
yeah,
where we presented a case to each other. And I really liked doing those episodes.
Yes, I do. But like I said, it's too much work, especially when we've got the other thing that we're not mentioning right now. Maybe yeah, once that's finished, we can just do joint ones every week.
Yeah. And then like there is sometimes where you have a really big case that's quite good to do as a single one.
Yeah.
Because like it's a lot of information.
Yeah.
And I'm a bit bad at like deep diving into stuff and finding, like going off on a bit of a trail.
Yeah. Whereas I'm just like, oh, okay.
You're like straight to the point. But maybe that's why we work so well together. Because like you're very straight to the point. Whereas I'm like, woo, I found a conspiracy theory from like the 1800s. And then... And I'll add it to the, which is completely unreasonable and definitely not likely, but you know, it's not impossible, so I'm going to include it.
But you also don't believe in aliens, so.
Yeah. No, but I mean, like, weird conspiracy is like people, like, they go a really long-winded way about the theory of how the crime could have happened. And it's like technically not impossible,
yeah,
but it's also highly unlikely.
Yes. So for today's joint theme.
Yes.
Is like killer who has inspired like a movie or TV show or any kind of media that we've.
Yeah.
So mine actually inspired a franchise.
Ooh.
In the end, because I think I'll wait until I've gone through and then I'll try and get you to guess
what it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think there's many clues. Hmm.
Oh,
it's in the 90s.
Guessing. Okay.
It's in the 90s.
Also, I'd like to point out I'm not very good at remembering film names. Like, I'll know what they are.
Okay.
But, like, I don't know the name.
Okay.
So this could be a very long guessing game.
Okay.
And I might be really shit at it. So we'll see how we go. Okay. I'll have like a number of guesses. And then if I don't get it, you're going to have to
I'll give you some clues.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm going to Shreveport in Louisiana.
Okay. America.
Yes.
Good start.
Well done. And it's May 26th of 1954. And this is when Daniel Harold Rowling was born to a police officer named James and his wife Claudia.
Okay.
I'm assuming Claudia is just a housewife because it's not stated what she did
as a job. Okay.
But then again, it's the 50s. Women get forgotten about. So Daniel goes by Danny for the rest of his life, and James and Claudia have another son called Kevin, but I don't know if he's younger or older than Danny.
Okay.
So, James was a police officer, but he wasn't a very nice man. He abused his sons and wife regularly and told Danny that he was unwanted since he was born.
Oh, okay, that's not very nice of him.
He would beat them over tiny things of, like, them not breathing right.
All right, okay.
It's like, it would just infuriate him, so he was very, like, had a massive temper on him. So I imagine it was a very tense childhood, and I imagine Claudia would always be walking on eggshells to try and not set James off, but it would never be her fault because it's him.
Yeah.
In one incident, Claudia went to the hospital after claiming her husband tried to make her cut herself with a razor blade. She made repeated attempts to leave her husband, but always returned shortly after.
Which I think is quite common
Very common. It's common now as well. Like, yeah, the dangerous part of to leave someone who's abusive is like once you've left them.
It's the actual leaving, yeah. It's like they say, is it like the first 6 or 9 months or something after you leave that person is like the time you're most likely to get attacked by them or killed.
Yeah.
Which is weird because you think leaving them makes it better. And in the long run, yes, it does. Make them, yes. You are better to leave, don't stay in the relationship. But yeah, you kind of need a support network.
Yeah. As long as you've got that, hopefully. People who are in abusive relationships, don't abuse your partner, for fuck's sake. It's not... Anyway. In one example against Danny, he pinned him to the ground and handcuffed him and then told the police to take his son away because he was embarrassed by him.
Oh, wow. He sounds like a real charming man.
There may have been some animal abuse as well, but I don't want to cover
classic serial killer.
This is the dad.
Oh, okay.
And the dad is not the killer here.
Well, he might just have some crimes that he's managed to cover up.
Mm-hmm. As Danny grew up, he struggled to fit into society and he didn't have jobs. And at some point it stated he was a waiter, but I think he was homeless.
Okay.
He'd been arrested in his teens for stealing and apparently he watched girls undress. But yeah. I don't think that
he's
was on his...
He's a bit of a peeping Tom.
Yeah. And nothing's really known about the next part of his life until he's 35.
Okay.
So he's kind of a drifter.
And he's gone under the radar.
Mm-hmm. And this is where the killings begin. So in the early morning hours of Friday, August 24th of 1990, Danny broke into the apartment shared by two university freshmen, 18-year-old Sonia Larson and 17-year-old Christina Powell. Finding Powell asleep downstairs on the sofa, he stood over to watch her, but he didn't wake her up. Mm-hmm. He then decided to go upstairs to the bedroom where Larson was asleep. Danny murdered her, first taping her mouth shut to keep her quiet, then stabbing her to death with a K-bar knife. She died trying to fend him off.
Oh.
And there's going to be trigger warnings from this poor edge. Yeah. So he went back downstairs. He taped Powell's mouth shut, bounding her wrists together behind her back, threatened her with a knife as he cut her clothes off. He then raped her and stabbed her 5 times in the back. He then posed both their bodies sexually provocatively. Not worried about getting caught in the apartment, he took a shower before leaving.
Oh. He's also very similar to... Was it the Times Square killer?
Yes.
Quite similar, isn't it?
Hmm. I'm sorry, I'm just trying to remember the man. Yeah.
Yeah, because was that 80s? Was it 70s? I can't remember.
70s into 80s.
Yeah. Hmm. Maybe you heard about it and it gave him inspiration.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
A day later... Only a day later, on Saturday, August 25th, Danny broke into the apartment of 18-year-old chemistry honors student at a nearby Santa Fe college, and her name is Krista Hoyt. He pried open a sliding glass door with a screwdriver, and this is this is his MO, this is how he gets into people's houses.
Okay.
So he's kind of like got a little kit bag with him. Finding she was not home, he waited in the living room for her to return.
Oh, so you're like lurking.
He's obviously watched certain people. I don't know if he watched the first two, but he definitely has his sights set on her.
But she's previously been a peeping Tom. He's obviously quite good at it.
Yeah. And at 11 a.m., she entered the home and he surprised her from behind, placing her in a chokehold. After she had been subdued, he placed duct tape on her mouth to gag her and bound her wrists together behind her back and led her into the bedroom. And he cut her clothes from her body and raped her. As in the Powell murder, he forced her to lie face down on the bed and stabbed her in the back, rupturing in her artery. He then flipped her body over and sliced open her abdomen from her pubic bone to her breastbone.
Oh.
Arriving back at his campsite, so he doesn't have a house, Danny could not find his wallet. Thinking he may have left it at the murder scene, he returned there, at which time he decided he wasn't finished, so he decapitated her.
Oh, fucking hell.
And then he ended up posing her body at a position, sitting position at the edge of her bed and placed her head on a shelf facing the corpse.
Oh, no, I don't like it. Like, it's like you're watching your own dead body.
He did
this. Even though, like, you can't physically do it, but...
He did it so it would, like... It would repulse the person who finds her even more.
Mm, yeah, I don't know. It's giving me goosebumps. I don't like that one. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just imagining walking in and there's just a random fucking head on the shelf.
By the way, these are in Gainesville, Florida. So he's made his way from Louisiana into Florida.
So he's moving about. Mm-hmm. Okay.
At this point, the murders of three young women, and all, by the way, they all match his mum perfectly. They're all white, petite brunettes with brown eyes.
Okay. Is he angry at his mum for not doing something against the dad?
I assume so. Maybe he thought she was, like, maybe complicit.
Yeah. Or, like, he just felt like she should have done more to stop it.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So, obviously, the news of the women started to spread in the news. There wasn't a curfew like in the movie this inspired, but students started to go places in groups, changing routines and sleeping together in groups as a precaution.
Okay.
But, obviously... Danny found someone that he could
didn't
Only on that Monday, the 27th of August, he broke into the apartment of 23-year-old Tracy Pauls, or Paulez, and her roommate Manny Tabadeo, and he's also 23. He found Manny asleep in one of the bedrooms and killed him after a struggle.
Yeah.
Tracy heard the struggle and ran towards the noise and saw Danny, so she tried to barricade herself in her room. But Danny broke through the door. He taped her mouth shut and tied her wrist, cut off her clothing and raped her before turning her over and stabbed her 3 times in the back. Mm-hmm. He posed Tracy's body, but he left Manny in the same position as he died. So it's all about the women for him.
I was about to say, because it's his first male victim, but is that just because he happened to be there and he needed to get rid of him?
So I'm assuming Tracy thought she was kind of safe because, like, she had a male roommate.
Yeah. So it's like he's like, sees his mum, like, it's like a backstabbing sort of.
Yeah. And it's also, he has to stab them in the back. He can't look at their face while he's doing it.
Yeah.
Like, he can gladly rape them, however, but once he wants to kill them, he has to turn them away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Law enforcement didn't have any leads, but they ended up having 2 suspects that weren't Danny. One was a student at the University of Florida, but he wasn't connected to these murders, so he was no longer a suspect.
Okay.
But his mugshot was shown around for a period of time, but was once cleared as soon as Danny was arrested.
Right, okay.
I think they went after him for a while because he had some mental illnesses.
Right, okay.
He was also in a car accident, so he had a scarred face, so he kind of would look like
your stereotypical attacker. Yeah. And also, without sounding harsh, it's easy to blame the mad person.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds plausible, like, well, they're deranged, so that's why they would do something so horrific.
Yeah.
Mm.
I didn't want to name him because, obviously,
yeah, he didn't do anything.
Yeah. They didn't state who the other suspect was, so I thought, if this guy clearly wasn't him, it wasn't him. Louisiana police, mm-hmm. So back in his home state, they alerted Florida authorities to an unsolved triple murder in Shreveport that happened on November 4th, 1989. Detective noticed that there were similarities between the Gainesville murders and those of 55-year-old Tom Grissom, his 24-year-old daughter Julie, and his 8-year-old grandson Sean.
Oh, so this is a little bit different then.
Mm-hmm. The family had been attacked in their home as they were preparing dinner. Afterward, Julie Grissom's body had been mutilated, cleaned, and posed.
Ah, okay. It's quite a feat to take on 3 people, though.
Yeah.
Especially as that was, like, earlier on.
Mm.
It's not like he got more confident in attacking people and went for 3 later on.
Hmm.
Hmm.
It's very, yeah, I... Mm. Yeah. Don Maines, an investigator on the case with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, he travelled to Shreveport in November 1990 because of the similarities.
Yeah.
They included posing of the victims, tape residue on the victim body, vinegar used to clean the body. Maines stated that they tested the body fluids from the perpetrator in Shreveport and found that this person also had type B, and this matched the evidence gained in Gainesville. And this was apparently the revelation in the case.
Okay.
Shortly after this, Cindy Giorgi, she called Crime Stoppers, and she lives in Shreveport.
Yeah.
She reported that Danny Rowling was possibly connected to the murders in both cities. 3 months earlier, in August 1990, Julie heard a news report about a string of murders as she traveled through Florida. Report made her think about Danny, who she had met at her Louisiana hometown church, and the possible link to the murders of in Shreveport.
Mm-hmm.
Danny had said deeply disturbing things to both her and her then husband, Steve Dobbin.
Right, okay.
Steven told her that Danny had told him, so word of mouth, that he had a problem. Steven asked what kind of problem, and Steven said, he likes to stick knives into people.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's very...
One, specific, but two, if you wanted to interpret it, would you see it as a backstabber? As in, like, you know, like when people go, oh, she backstabs, like, stabbing knives into you. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a metaphorical...
Yeah, it is. Obviously, she dismissed these comments when she heard about them and obviously didn't think that Danny would be capable of that, but then she couldn't get the murders in Gainesville out of her head.
Yeah.
And then when she was like, oh, similar murders in Shreveport, where Daniel was. So her tip actually led somewhere. Investigators responded to it and quickly found Danny, who, and he had been arrested in September the 7th, 1990, for supermarket robbery.
Oh.
The robbery had been committed 10 days after the bodies of Tracy and Manny were found.
Yeah.
Danny was being held in the Marion County Jail, just 40 miles south of Gainesville. Investigators determined that Danny had type B blood, which matched the blood found in the Shreveport. In Gainesville. Once Florida investigators realized that Danny had multiple convictions for armed robbery, they realized he could have also been responsible for the bank robbery that occurred the day Christina Hoyt's body was found.
So he's definitely got an escalation in crime.
Yeah. They returned to the evidence locker where the gun, screwdriver, bag of money and cassette player had been stored and listened to the tape. They also found tools matching marks left at the Gainesville murder scenes. That's the him entering the room with the screwdriver in the sliding glass doors. So obviously collecting all this evidence, or like going back through it, they eventually went through the small camp where he had been living, and this was in a wooded area near the apartment complexes frequented by students.
Okay.
And here they discovered audio diaries he had made alluding to the crimes.
Oh.
So you don't want to talk about it.
Yeah. Or if you do, like, don't record it.
Mm-hmm.
Just talk to yourself in your sleep in a room alone.
Later it was discovered that before the murders on August 5th, 1990, Danny broke into the home of Janet Frake in Florida, in Sarasota, which is a little bit further away. He bound and gagged her with duct tape while he sexually assaulted her, but he didn't kill her, so she couldn't match him.
Okay. So I wonder then what makes him want to kill some and not others?
Maybe she wasn't brunette. I didn't see what she looked like.
Okay.
Maybe he... But this was after the first...
So does that suggest that he doesn't necessarily want to kill her?
Maybe not. Maybe... Yeah, maybe she was the only one that kind of like came out. But maybe there was others that he attacked but didn't kill that just didn't want to talk about it, so they never reported it.
Mm-hmm.
Could be more of them. So in November 1991, Danny was charged with 5 counts of murder. He was brought to trial nearly 4 years after the murders.
Mm-hmm.
He claimed that his motive was to become a superstar similar to Ted Bundy. In 1994, before his trial could get underway, he unexpectedly pleaded guilty.
So it wasn't too far, actually, even though it wasn't Ted Bundy I was talking about a Times Square killer, but he is clearly influenced by other killers.
Mm-hmm. This is what some men are, well, some killers are, aren't they? They want the notoriety, whether that's what their motive is. They just want to be famous for killing people.
Out of all the things you want to be famous for.
Yeah. On April 20th, 1994... Danny was sentenced to death and he was executed by lethal injection October 25th, 2006. So, what film do you think...
This is where I'm struggling, because I recognise some of the names, but I don't think I've watched a film with them in. I think I might have watched an actual documentary.
Okay.
It's
a franchise that started in the 90s. I would say 96, 97.
Oh. How many thingies is it if it's a franchise? So like how many?
It's recently come back. It was like 3, and then I think they've done the last 3 in the past 10 years. It starts off with like a phone call. And it's like, what's your favourite scary movie?
Oh, okay, so it's not the one I was thinking of.
It's got a little white mask.
It's not Scream, is it?
It's Scream.
Is it Scream?
Yep.
See, I went for that and then I was like, I'm not sure whether it was.
So after these murders...
I haven't seen the newer Scream.
I've only seen
the older ones.
Yeah, I've only seen the first 2, 3, maybe. Maybe seen the fourth one.
I think I'm a bit worried that, like, you know, when they do the newer ones, they're not going to be as good as the
first one was, like, great. Could have just left it at that.
Yeah, because they did that with Halloween.
Yeah.
I think the middle ones lost it a little bit.
Yeah. So the writer, can't remember their name, wrote the screenplay after they saw the Gainesville killer in the news, he wrote the story, Wes Craven.
I recognise the names of some of the victims, so I wonder if I might have watched a documentary on them at some point. Quite possibly. Yeah. I've watched a lot of crime documentaries. Because I hate it as well, you know, when you listen to somebody's like, oh, I swear I've watched this before, and it's not, it's just got, the people have got really similar names. Especially ones, I went through a phase of watching loads of documentaries about unsolved murders of women in America from like the 70s.
Okay.
But like they all weirdly end up blending in as the same.
Yeah.
Because there were so many and they all have similar names. I was like, I swear I've watched this documentary before. And then I was like, maybe I haven't. Maybe they just all have the same name. And it was very weird.
It's just scary that, obviously we know that men are most likely to be serial killers than women. And then you like look through all the women that have been killed and you're like, oh, okay.
I know, there's a large amount. And then there's all the ones that haven't been, because that's the big thing. Like, it still happened here, obviously, but America's got like a ridiculous amount of unsolved murders of especially women in the 70s and 80s. Mm.
It's like I've said before, and I'll say it again, I wanted us to cover more of the victims with the podcast, but it's harder.
It is. It's hard to get the information.
Yeah.
But it's so much more easier to get the criminal side of it, and that's because it's documented.
Yeah.
Whereas especially with a lot of these victims, they were either women that were like wandering about, or the prostitutes, or they didn't have any family or friends. Mm-hmm. So like no one made any note of them.
Or it's just like their claim to fame or their stamp in history is that they've been murdered.
Yeah.
By a killer.
And you just get the box standard, oh yeah, they were a lovely person. I'm like, okay, but could you like maybe tell me some more about them? Like,
I feel I would like is to maybe do that, maybe branch off a little bit with that, but it would be a lot more work, and maybe people aren't interested in that. People are interested
in the gore, which to be fair is when you're looking at it you're like, okay, I want to know what they did and how they got caught.
I'd admit it too, because it's like, how can another person do that to someone else?
And I like the way looking at like how it's been caught, or like how they've been missed. Because I like to think of it as like, how did they possibly miss that? But then also there's some other clever ones. You can go, oh God, this criminal was really smart. Like, it's weird, but you're like, I like to sort of analyse the criminal's mind.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
That's and what like I mean when it's fascinating. It's like how this person.
Because it's like, you shouldn't be like, wow, they are really clever. But then also it's a bit like, actually, they did do a really good job of that. Like, it sounds bad.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting to look at it and think, oh no, that was really smart, because there is some blatantly just really stupid ones.
Like I said, like what's going on now with the four college students that were murdered in the same house. How could one man, that is apparently who was supposed to have done it, killed four people?
Especially with the advances in technology as well.
But like, how? How did no one else in the house realise? Because he didn't kill everyone in the house.
But have we really become more self-centred now that we actually don't pay attention to what's going on around us? I think
that
phones
I think
and
that
social
is,
media.
Yeah.
Cause like, you know, before, like, you would notice things, like things that seemed out of character. Like, you'd see people, like, beat people every day. And then if you didn't see them for a day or two, like, you'd be really suspicious. Yet you think now with social media how easy it is to just not speak to, like, or physically see someone for months. And at the end of the day, it could be anyone sending you that message. It doesn't have to be the other person. It's only maybe if they write something that's really weird or peculiar, like, that person wouldn't send.
Oh, you mean, like, when you got hacked and it was, like, y'all? And I was like, it's clearly not you.
But you know what I mean? It's not until,
like,
someone says something really weird. Like, you could unknowingly be speaking to someone pretending to be them for months and have absolutely no idea.
I do think that sometimes, you know. I'm like, is this person who I'm actually talking to?
Because, like, you've got everything, like, working from, like, home and stuff now. Like, so many people, like, stay away and do their own things. Like, you don't have to see people. Like, we've weirdly, like, regressed a little bit. Like, we've gone, even if you go in shops, like, you don't have to communicate with anyone now. You can, like, go in, sort of hide yourself, grab your stuff and disappear, and, like, no one even knows you were there.
Yeah, I think COVID, obviously, it was going this way before COVID because everything was automated, but COVID has had a massive...
Yeah, I just don't think there's... It's weird, in some aspects, there's more community, like, community, because in some aspects, like, we're more sympathetic towards people on certain things, but then there's other areas where, we're, like I said, we've completely gone their own way, and we've almost, we're quite happy to be alone now. And do our own thing, that we're like, we don't really rely on anyone else because we've got technology that allows us to do these things and stuff. So we almost, it's like we do need a community, but we don't at the same time for certain things now. And I don't think we connect or interact in the same way that we used to.
I think our generation is a bit better, but the generations below us.
Yeah, I think they'll get to the point. Yeah. Like, I don't want to say self-centered because I don't really think that's very fair, but.
Just everything is in their hand.
Yeah.
So they don't need to look outside. They
They've not got to make connections with other people in order to get through life, if that makes sense. Yeah. They can effectively survive by themselves. not necessarily survive, but
it's how their life is going to be.
Yeah, they can get access to things without having to communicate with people to get it.
Yeah, and that's scary.
It is a bit, because I feel like it's going to isolate a hell of a lot more people without them realizing.
Yeah,
it's like they'll be like that far down the hole that they then can't get themselves out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
So what do you have for me?
Okay, well, I've got a slightly different. Mine isn't a film. Mine's a TV drama.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. Like, it wasn't. It didn't have to be a film.
Well, it was more. I was doing it, and you were like, "Oh, it's going to be a surprise what mine is," and then I was like, "Yeah, but then what if I do the same film?" So then
it won't be.
So I thought. I know, but like the chances are, like, yeah. I know there's so many out there, but I was like, can you imagine, like, what if the chances are that we covered the same thing? So I'm going with a TV drama that was made in 2020. However, the crime actually happened in 1985, and it's a British drama, so I'm not entirely sure if those in other countries will be able to watch this.
There's BritBox, people can...
Can they still get that in other countries?
I think so, yes.
Okay, well, if they can, you might want to go and look for... Or if you're in the UK and you haven't watched it, you might want to go and have a little look on ITV Player, or is it ITV Hub now? Don't know what the fuck they call it. They keep changing it.
I don't know. ITVX. Yeah, I don't know.
I don't fucking know. Well, it was originally on ITV, okay? So anything that you can get those programmes on, go and have a look on that. And this is the White House Farm murders.
I know what you're
okay. Yep. I'd heard a little bit about the crime before, but it was one of those things I sort of like read over it, like in something in a book, and then kind of forgot about it.
Mm.
And because I'd forgotten about it, when I watched the drama, even though I knew it was based off a true crime, it's one of those dramas that keeps you guessing to the end because you think, like,
is this the who's... son?
Yes. Yeah. Who's going to be the killer?
Sorry.
It's one of those things. No, it's all right, because I'm going to go into it. Yeah. But it's one of those things that, even though you know it's true crime, like the way they've done the drama, it makes you guess, like, you keep thinking, oh my god, who's going to end up being the killer? Like, there's so many twists and turns in it, like the way they've done it is very, very clever. So even if you know about the crime, I definitely recommend you go and watch the drama, because I think it's really, really good.
I'm trying to think who played the people.
Is it Freddie Fox who played the killer?
Yeah.
Guess, there was a lot of big names in it. Yeah,
no offense to him, but he does look a bit
like he could be a killer. But there's certain, then I say that, but then, like, when we got David Tennant to play Dennis Nielsen, he looked so fucking good as him. Like, it was a real good take, and I was like, this is slightly scary, but like, he played him so well.
Yeah. I think you just have to
there's certain people that have just got a knack for it, I think. Okay. So obviously, White House Farm, this is the crimes committed by a man by the name of Jeremy Bamber, and he would murder several members of his family back in 1985.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, I just remembered what he did.
Yeah. This is quite a bloodied murder as well, I'm not going to lie, so if you're a bit squeamish, I mean, to be fair, if you're squeamish, I don't know why you listen to true crime podcasts, but, you know, here we go, here's your warning. Okay. So... before I talk specifically about the crime, I want to talk a little bit about Jeremy and what his life was like before. So, Jeremy Neville Bamber was actually...
Another Neville.
Hey? Another Neville. Well, there's going to be multiple Nevilles in this.
Okay. Dad's a Neville, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Jeremy Neville Bamber, who was actually born Jeremy Paul Marsham, would go on to be convicted of the mass murders of his adoptive parents, Neville and June Bamber, his adoptive sister, Sheila Caffell, as well as his nephews, Daniel and Nicholas Caffell. Okay, so who was Jeremy? Well, he was born to a lady by the name of Juliet Dorothy Wheeler, who was born here in Leicester.
Oh, was she?
Mm. She was a vicar's daughter, and she'd had an affair with a man by the name of Leslie Bryan Marsham. Okay. Juliet gave Jeremy up for adoption the year that he was born through the Church of England Children's Society. Now, I couldn't find much on her, and I don't want to speculate, but I'm wondering if the fact it was an affair, if her dad was maybe not very happy about it, and he also had links with the church, if he suggested she gave the baby up. However, I did find out later, I believe she ends up marrying the man that, Jeremy's dad. So I wonder if maybe they got together much later on.
Maybe.
And they weren't aware of, obviously, because there was a name change during the adoption, they didn't know that Bamber was their son until it came out in the press, and press contacted his birth mom, obviously trying to find information on him. And that's how they found out that's how she found out that her actual son ended up being a mass murderer.
She's probably just like, thank God, that we gave him up.
But yeah, but then also is that element of people are going to then blame her, like, well, if you hadn't given him up for adoption, and blah, blah, blah. Like, it isn't why he murdered the family, but people will throw any accusation about.
He wanted money, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
So Neville and June adopted Jeremy when he was just 6 months old.
Mm-hmm.
Neville and Juliet... why did I put Juliet? June. Neville and June, sorry, were farmers, and they lived in a large Georgian-style farmhouse at White House Farm.
Mm-hmm.
Which is in Essex. Neville had previously been a local magistrate and a former RAF pilot. And in 1957, just a few months before adopting... Sorry, a few years before adopting Jeremy, Neville and June had also adopted a baby girl by the name of Sheila. So obviously she becomes Jeremy's adoptive sister.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up, Jeremy attended private and boarding schools. However, he finished school with no qualifications. Neville obviously wasn't particularly happy about this and didn't approve, so Jeremy ended up going on to study O-levels at a sixth form college in Colchester, in which he did gain 7 qualifications. Afterwards, Neville paid for Jeremy to travel to Australia, where he took up scuba diving courses, and I think he started to mix with quite affluent people. Like, they weren't poor to start off with, but I think he made himself out to be...
A bit more well off than
than he was.
Yeah, I think I kind of remember that scene of him coming back.
And he gave me a bit of like knobhead vibes.
Yeah.
Like private school boy.
Yeah.
I'm a bit of a prick.
Yeah. He is.
I mean, he is a prick. He mass murdered people, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. And
your stereotypical British private boy, school private boy, I am better than everyone else. It was giving off that vibe.
Yeah.
Okay. It was after his time in Australia, his possible criminal life was about to start. So as soon as he got bored of Australia, Jeremy travelled to New Zealand. Friends that knew him from that period in time claimed that Jeremy had told them that he'd been ripped off by a heroin dealer and had boasted that he'd been smuggling heroin overseas as well as robbing jewellery stores to steal expensive watches, one of which he gave to his girlfriend who was living back in the UK.
Okay.
Now, there
Why would you admit that?
I'm not sure if it's him trying to make himself sound better, because...
Sound better?
Like bigging himself up.
Okay.
Like, making himself to be like a bad guy, like, you don't mess with me. Like,
okay, posh boy.
No, but I think he's trying... Like, some people saw him, like, he's just travelling the country using his...
daddy's mummy.
Yeah, and he's like, no, actually, like, I'm a criminal, like, mastermind. Like, I think, like, he thought he would sound cool, but
yeah,
he's not quite doing it right. Also, there was some crimes that happened in these times committed by people from overseas. I don't know as though he was actually involved in them, or whether he jumped on the bandwagon of used these real crimes that happened and claimed he was a part of it.
Okay,
so I don't know whether he was involved or if he tried to make it out like he was.
Just seems silly to me to commit.
But I wonder if he was quite... I got the impression that he was quite high on drugs all the time.
Okay.
And if he went... I think, like, he went to a lot of parties and everyone was like, oh, how can you get this? And he's like, I can get hold of some for you.
Okay.
And people are like, oh, how can you do this? Like, he gets high or gets drunk and then, like, sells these vivid stories.
Okay.
And I think because that these actual crimes have happened...
He's just like, I did that.
Yeah, I did that. So I don't know as though he was actually involved in the crimes or whether he's just claiming to be.
Just maybe don't confess to something just in case.
Well, either way, he was getting away with it if he was involved. Okay. So a cousin of Jeremy then claimed that he ended up having to leave New Zealand in a hurry after Jeremy's friends were involved in an armed robbery. And this is why I'm saying we don't know whether he was actually involved or if he's just... trying to plant himself, and then something actually happens, someone gets caught and he thinks, oh shit, I said I was a part of that, I'm doing a runner.
Yeah.
Whether he was or wasn't involved.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When Jeremy returned to the UK, he worked in bars and restaurants, and he soon returned to work at the farm with Neville. Neville gave him a car and allowed him to live rent-free in a cottage that he owned 3 miles away from the farm.
Mm-hmm.
He obviously did pay him. However, it was said at the time that Jeremy complained of the low wages that Neville was paying him. He got a house for free. He was given a car.
Yeah.
Neville had already paid for all of his education, as well as sending him around the world on nice trips and scuba diving courses. I feel like Jeremy at this point... he'd gone beyond being a bit spoiled, but I also feel like maybe the people he was hanging around with were spoiled,
mm-hmm.
and he was seeing that they weren't really having to work and were getting these very nice things, and that's what he wanted. That's what I feel
Yeah, but that's not how life works. No, you have to work.
He wanted everything for nothing, mm-hmm. basically. Okay. So I'm now going to move on to the murders. Mm-hmm. So if you don't like gory things, now is your warning. Okay. Jeremy claimed to have alerted police at 3:30 a.m. on the 7th of August, 1985. He claims that Neville had rang him to say that his sister, Sheila, who it's worth noting does have a diagnosis of schizophrenia.
Yep, which he leans into.
Mm-hmm. And that she'd gone berserk with one of Neville's rifles. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he's setting a scene. Police were dispatched to White House Farm, where they would be greeted with a very grisly scene. Sheila was found dead on the floor of her parents' bedroom with a rifle up against her throat. June was found in the same room, deceased with gunshot wounds. Sheila's then six-year-old sons, Nicholas and Daniel, were found in their beds in one of the rooms upstairs, and Neville was found dead in the kitchen. The family had been shot a total of 25 times, and most of those gunshots were at close range.
Yeah.
Okay, and I have got a bit more information on the specifics of each one. So Neville had been shot 8 times, 4 of those in his head. Okay. Yeah. June had been shot 7 times all over her body, but the one between like right in the middle of her eyes, that was at point blank range, and blood smears on the floor suggested that she tried to crawl away.
Yeah.
So she didn't die instantly.
No.
Obviously Sheila, I think she had 2 gunshots.
Yes, because yeah.
It comes in later in the case. And the boys, I think they just had like a single one each, but it was noted that the boy still like had, one of them still had his thumb in his mouth, so like he was literally asleep, like he didn't even wake up, which in a weird way I think is a bit of a mercy, because
it's the best.
Yeah, he just basically went in his sleep.
Yeah.
Okay. It was obviously quite easy for police to believe that Sheila had committed the murders, as she'd only recently been released from a psychiatric hospital in which she was receiving treatment for her schizophrenia. So at first, the police went in and was like, oh yeah, she had a... They thought it was like a murder-suicide. Yeah,
the theory is she killed everyone then killed herself.
Yeah.
But how do you shoot yourself twice?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is what I'm going to get into. However, the police believe the story for a little bit, but there was a few in the case that were a bit like, this is a bit iffy, but he didn't really have much standing. He wasn't a high up officer. So I think it was a case of, I've got to find something to prove it.
Yeah.
The case unravelled, however, when Jeremy's girlfriend, Julie Mugford, went to police. And this was because of, like, he was already roused suspicion because of his behaviour at the funeral.
Yeah.
But also then he was saying things to her and he made comments about stuff, and she obviously, they then ended up splitting up and she became concerned about his behaviour, so she went to the police. When the case finally made it to the court, the prosecution argued that there was no way Neville could have rang Jeremy for help, especially when you think he's got 4 gunshot wounds in his head. So how was he picking up the phone?
He really hated his dad, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
4 shots to the head.
Yeah.
Jesus.
And 8 in total. So he had multiple. And he had a beating. He was the one that was beaten as well. Yeah. So that was like a really sustained attack. There was also no blood on the phone. So by this point, he would have already had to been shot to ring Jeremy to say, Sheila's attacking me. So you would expect blood on the phone. And why would Neville ring Jeremy and not the police or an ambulance?
Yeah.
Okay. Also, there was a silencer found for the rifle. However, this wasn't located until a few days afterwards, and I'll get into that in a minute. But initially, the silencer was put on the rifle when it was at court, and it was said that there was no way Sheila could have extended her arm, or her arms went long enough for her to be able to do that and then shoot herself in the throat.
And then also remove the silencer after she's dead.
Yeah.
And then go hide it.
In a cupboard downstairs.
Yeah.
Though some were saying, did it get knocked over or like dropped in the process? Like the defence tried to argue that it got dropped or moved by the police, like as they were dismantling the scene. And so that actually it was on the rifle, because I think there was a bit of a conflicting thing in the statements. One officer claimed it was on the rifle at the time, and another one was like, well, I can't really remember. And then obviously it was found 3 days later by a cousin going to the house and then was handed into the police.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I feel like it would have needed the silencer on the gun.
Yeah, of course.
To be able to not alert the rest of the family, otherwise you're going to struggle to kill the whole family. I feel like he maybe went for the children first.
Yeah.
Or the mum. And then that obviously alerted Neville. Then he had to fight him off.
Yeah.
To then...
He was overkill.
Yeah. Okay. So we also... there'd also been obviously a violent struggle between Neville and the killer in the kitchen, yet Sheila didn't have any wounds to match a physical altercation. She only had the gunshot wounds. I say only, but, you know, I mean, it didn't indicate she'd been in a fight with Neville. Plus, she was much smaller, so the prosecution argued that she wouldn't have been able to fight off someone as big as Neville. No. Which, obviously, it's not impossible. If you're enraged, you could do, but adding it to the other things, it's quite unlikely. They also argued the fact that she'd been shot twice meant it was very unlikely to be a suicide. Because it's not impossible that your first shot could not kill you, but to shoot yourself twice in the throat, well, I don't know, it's a bit...
Yeah, I mean,
you know, if one was in the arm, you could say, I don't know, the gun went off in the wrong direction, you shot yourself in the shoulder, so now you do it a second time to get yourself in the head. But
if the location, to the throat,
I don't think that was a suicide.
No.
Jeremy's defence argued that the silencer may not have been on the gun at the time of the shootings, and therefore she would have been able to shoot herself. But again, I'm still... Twice. I think they're pulling at strings here. And obviously they played on the whole thing of it wasn't handed in and logged until a few days after the murder, so there was no proof it was on the gun at the time of the thing. However, prosecution argued that some of Sheila's blood had been found on the silencer. So... how did her blood get on the silencer?
Mm-hmm.
Again, the defence argued, I think, like cross-contamination, but meh. I'm not going with that. The call logs did also show that a phone call had been made from the address to police on the evening, but either it didn't properly go through or it was answered and no one answered on the other end.
Okay,
so there was no recording of a voice. So you couldn't say whether it was Neville or Jeremy, because I feel like it might have been Jeremy trying to ring from the house to pretend... that someone tried to make a call.
Okay, yeah. I see what you're saying.
So, obviously at the time, even though Jeremy's always protested that his innocence, the police strongly went with the motive was he wanted the estate and the money for himself, because I think there was like $500,000 worth of money, and obviously back in the 80s, that's quite a bit of money. Like, you could have lived off that pretty much for the rest of your life. And obviously you would have had a big house, so no mortgage, and... he would have inherited everything.
Yes, and obviously he was work shy.
Because
how old is he at this point?
He's 20s. I want to say he was 24.
Okay. A little bit younger than what I thought. But I feel like he's never worked a day in his life and he doesn't want to.
Yeah.
He's had everything handed to him and he's just like...
I feel like even though he's had a good life in the sense of like Neville and June have paid for everything.
Yeah.
I feel like he thinks, you know, like maybe because he was adopted, like he's had a shit start, like someone didn't want it. Like, I feel like he'd probably use it as an excuse.
He's leaning into that. It's a victim mentality when it's like, they've given you literally everything.
And I think he could quite easily play on the thing of, well, they didn't love me that much, they sent me to boarding school. Like, it's not an excuse. But I feel like he could play on things like that and twist it to like, they didn't really want me, they were horrible, they sent me away.
Okay, he could have been in an orphanage.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I don't agree with sending children to boarding school, but probably in their eyes, they're like, oh, it's a better education.
Yeah, and therefore, I feel like that's what Neville would have had.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very much a generational thing. Like, you find at that time, a lot of men, if they went, when they then go on to have children, they send their own children to boarding school because, like, that was the best education that money could buy. And
they want the best for you.
Yeah.
Which is probably not the right thing to do, but they think it's the right thing for their child. So they are sending...
And I think especially still in the 80s, I think there was a big gap between private school and state school, whereas now a lot of kids that go to state school can still get into the universities that private school kids... Because before, years ago, like state school kids didn't get into Oxford and Cambridge,
of course not.
Whereas now there's quite a large number. So it's a case of you send those private and boarding schools to give your child the best opportunity.
He was kind of clever in that he was like, oh, my sister's just had this...
Oh, it was a brilliant motive. It was just there was a few slip-ups that didn't quite work out properly. And he was too cocky.
Yeah.
Because I think there was a comment he made something about, like, oh, I can't wait to move in here. Like, it was, like, literally, like, the day after.
It was, like, it's obvious that he's, like, happy that they're dead.
Because
he's like, oh, when once the inheritance comes through.
Yeah. But he was very good at showing, like, putting on a show at the actual funeral, like, by the graveside, because, like, people made comments. But, like, because there was newspaper things with some showing, like, how distraught he was and things like that. He was a very good actor. And very good at putting on an act. And like I said, it fell into his hands that Sheila happened to have a mental illness because it was the perfect excuse.
Yeah.
It was only because there was a few things that didn't quite add up and his own smarmy, gittish personality.
He just seems like he's a slimy person. And Freddie Fox, who played him, played
did
it well.
Perfectly. I know. Yeah.
It's like,
But yeah, obviously, like, I know you know what happens in The Crown now and you know what's going to happen in the ending, but I definitely, if you haven't already, I recommend you go and watch the dramas.
Yeah.
Because it was one of those things, like, because obviously the way they've done it in the film, obviously they're making it out like the sister did it, like a good way through. And even at like one point, even to the end, I was like, oh, they're just going to twist it. And they're like, they're not going to find him guilty. And I think, I know they do find him guilty because I know what happens at the end of The Crown. But it's one of those things, there is sometimes you do think with TV adaptations, are they just going to twist it at the end and like not stick to the actual facts, and like literally the whole drama kept you guessing as like what was going to happen.
Because I remember like whoever was the police officer, like you could see him thinking like, well, that's not right.
It was very cleverly done, and I think they got brilliant actors, like the actors played the characters very, very well. Yeah, it's definitely, I think, to be fair, we're quite good at doing British dramas.
We are
very good. I've watched some absolutely phenomenal ones over the years. I'm like, woo, I want to watch it again. Like, I really enjoyed it. But yeah, no, I thought it was a very good one. So maybe we'll need to do another episode like this and we'll pick another one out, because I've got a few. Because I obviously, weirdly, if I knew months ago we were going to do this, I should have not done my John Christie and our police episode, because then I could have done Rillison Place, which was made not only into a film, but also a BBC adaptation. And that was very, very good.
Well, I had Danny Rowling in like my upcoming episodes for ages. And then we were like, we need a joint one. So I was just like, what about killers who inspired stuff?
But yeah, it's very good. So yeah, if you want to go and watch this one, watch that. And also I suggest you go and watch the Rillington one, which relates to the, I'm sure it was the Police That Commit Crime episode that I mentioned John Christie in.
I think so.
I think it was.
I think so.
I'll find the information out, and then when I make the Instagram or TikTok post, I'll tag it in it. But yeah, I suggest also you go and either watch the film or the Rillington Place TV adaptation. I think it was BBC that did Rillington Place.
Can't remember that one.
I've watched it, it's very good. I haven't watched the actual movie, which I believe was made in the 70s, maybe 80s. I haven't watched the actual film, but I have watched the BBC adaptation of it. It's very good also. Yeah, I think that's it for today.
I think so.
Yeah, either that, or if maybe people have suggestion of ones that they want us to cover, send them in. We'll have a little listen and then see what we can do with it.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, I think that's it. So in the meantime,
keep creeping
and we'll keep digging.